Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today is the kickoff for this fall's election season. Candidate filing opened today for all the seats on Charlotte City Council, the Office of Mayor, and six school board seats. With one member of the council under federal indictment and another seat open because of a resignation, the contests may be more interesting than ever, but this is an off-year election, and turnout, which is usually low in Mecklenburg County for all elections, is likely to be even lower than normal. Yet local government and the leaders who guide it are really where the rubber meets the road. These elected officials have more influence over the policies that touch our lives than most national contests. So this hour, a look at the stakes of this election, at the potential candidates, and at some changes in the law that have gone into effect since the last municipal elections. We're joined by WFAE politics reporter Steve Harrison. Joe Bruno reports on politics and more for WSO CTV, and Tony Macia is founder and executive editor of The Ledger. Thank you all for being here. Good morning. Welcome.
Morning, Mike. Morning.
Steve, I'm going to begin with you, and I read that, and I guess if history is any indication, only about 15% of eligible voters vote in these off-year elections. So why do we do it this way? Why don't they put these municipal elections in the same cycle with the midterms and the presidential election? When people vote?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll say that 15% number in a way is actually lower, because if you go back to the 2023, the last municipal election we had, for Charlotte, basically everything, almost everything is decided in the primary, in the Democratic primary. And so turnout for that day was under 5%. So we had, you know, you've got all four at-large seats are basically decided in the primary, almost all of the council seats. And then, you know, we move to the general in November, and it's much higher. It is 15, but everything's decided. Nothing is all predetermined. So 5%, incredibly low.
This year, in addition to voting for those running for office, Joe, we are likely to be voting for a sales tax increase for Charlotte's transit plan. The General Assembly passed that plan. It went to the governor. He signed it. It now goes to Mecklenburg County Commission. I would assume, correct me if I'm wrong, that passage there is almost all but assured. Is this likely to increase voter turnout?
I think it will a little bit. I think that, you know, where we might have one major race like that we'll be keeping an eye on election night. In terms of city council, I would say D6 perhaps. But other than that, this is going to be the star of the show on the November ballot. There's going to be a lot of attention, like a $2 million ad campaign launched by or a $2 million campaign launched by the Alliance. You're going to be seeing and reading and hearing all about this tax. And I do think it will drive some people to the polls. It's not going to be a whole lot of people, but I bet we see an uptick in turnout this year because of it.
And although we follow all of this pretty closely and are up to speed pretty much on everything in that transit plan, Tony, most people don't. As we find out, that most people don't follow much of politics at all because they want to stay away from it as far as possible. But since the sales tax increase for transit is likely to win approval in the General Assembly, there's going to have to be this campaign that Joe alluded to. What are they going to have to say? How much work do they have to do to get voters up to speed on what this yes or no vote on transit sales tax will mean for them, and whether they should vote yes or no in their minds? How much work has to be done?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you talk to the backers of this increased tax, and it would be going from 7.25% to 8.25%, you know, one percentage point increase. You know, I think they will acknowledge that they have some work to do. I think they feel pretty good, I think, about where they are. Previous polls taken over the last few years show people are kind of split on it, and, you know, but are generally supportive of transit and transportation and more roads and more options and quicker commute times. People, I think, generally like that. I mean, really, it comes down to, okay, is it really worth what you're going to be paying? So I think they're trying to lay out what's going to happen in each of the different areas of the county? What can we see in terms of more roads or better intersections or an extended light rail line or better bus or micro transit? So they're going to lay all of that out, and they're going to frame it as an investment in the future. They're not going to say, well, you know, this is a tax, and, you know, but they're going to look at what are the things that are actually going to try to improve people's lives, you know, on transit. So they're going to lay it out like that.
And Joe, I said that it's likely, or it's all but assured, that the county commission will say yes to this, because everybody in this town has been working on this for years now. But is that true? Is it likely to, could it hit a snag? Could they say no? Could they want to make modifications to it? Or will it just sail through?
I think what will likely happen is, yes, it's going to be placed on the November ballot by the Mecklenburg County Commissioners. I think you might hear from one or two commissioners who might say, I'm not going to vote for this. I disagree with the plan, but I think voters should have a say. Because if you think about that one year, a couple of years ago, when we were talking about a quarter cent sales tax increase for the Art and Science Council and parks, that was what we heard. And that was a much more controversial proposal. And a lot of the Board of Commissioners did not like the actual proposal, but they said, I think voters should ultimately decide whether they want to do this, and voters said no.
Aside from folks in Matthews who don't like this because the Silver Line, Steve, is likely not to be part of this plan, the light rail to Matthews, is there any significant or organized opposition to this referendum?
I don't think any organized opposition yet. There are some leaders who are questioning whether it's the best plan. Former city council member Braxton Winston is kind of opposed to it. Former mayor Jennifer Roberts. Interestingly enough, I haven't seen the opposition I've seen has been kind of on the Democratic side, and often cities, when there are referendums to do transit and transport, especially transit, some of the opposition comes from the right, from Republican circles. I have not seen anything like that at all so far building this time, but maybe it's coming. I've missed it.
Joe.
I've noticed some pockets of misinformation or a misunderstanding of what the plan actually is. People saying, oh, why aren't we getting rail to the west side? Well, you are. Silver Line goes to the airport. Or why isn't East Charlotte getting anything? Well, the rail's going to Bojangles Coliseum, and you're also getting a streetcar plus micro transit and bus improvements, which most East Charlotte residents use anyway. So I think that a big part of this campaign will be actually informing people what this plan is, and also letting them know that this tax doesn't have a sunset. It's forever. So everything is going to get built. But it just, you know, right now the focus is on these projects that have been identified in the 30-year plan. It has to start with the red line. And then, you know, as the transit authority is going to ultimately decide when and what gets built after that.
And Tony, a month ago, or maybe a month and a half ago, if you'd asked anybody on the street whether the General Assembly would say yes to this, you would have gotten, I don't know, doesn't look like it. Even they said it was a 50-50 shot at getting through the legislature, and suddenly and without warning, it passed, it sailed through like a rocket ship. How do you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, it is sort of interesting if you think back to where we were a year and a half ago when the then Speaker of the House, Tim Moore, went to the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance and just sort of laid it out and sort of was making fun of a lot of the trains and all that. And here we are, and it passed. How did we get there? I mean, I think it was a lot of work from a lot of different sectors. You had the business community that was very involved, a group of very influential CEOs, I think, kind of kickstarted it. They just sort of worked in their different areas. You know, you had the Charlotte City Manager, who was very involved in getting the towns to kind of mostly agree, except for Matthews, like you mentioned, sort of on a structure that sort of gave money to roads but also did most of the transit things that they wanted. And then they started working with the General Assembly, which, as you point out, Mike, initially was thought, well, the Republicans in Raleigh are never going to agree to something that would result in a tax increase. Well, it turns out that they actually, I think had a little bit of an understanding that if this is something that they do in Mecklenburg, that this might be something they can do in other parts of the state to help, with transportation needs elsewhere. So It was really kind of a, you know, a little, probably a little bit of luck and a lot of work by a lot of different people to kind of put it over the finish line.
That surprised me, Joe, that the people in the legislature were, it suddenly dawned on them, if we give this to Mecklenburg, maybe other areas of the state would want it too, and that might not be a bad idea when South Carolina has been doing that penny tax for roads for years. I mean, this is not something that just came out of the ether. It's not new. Why did this suddenly dawn on them that this might be a way to handle future road improvements?
I think Tricia Cotham deserves a lot of credit. That's the name I've heard multiple times from people who aren't even public officials, just behind the scenes, her lobbying and efforts to get lawmakers on board. She's publicly said, hey, colleagues, if you want to do this for your communities, I'll show you how. I'll campaign and vote for it. She did a lot of work behind the scenes, from what I understand, to get her lawmakers on board.
So that will be the issue that everybody gets to vote on, no matter where you live in Mecklenburg County come November. In all likelihood, it's not a fait accompli yet, but it may be very shortly. So filing, as I said, for various offices, school board, city council, mayor, etc., opened this morning at 8 o'clock. It will run through Friday, the 18th of July at noon. Steve, do we know who has filed yet at this hour, an hour, 17 minutes and 31 seconds after the filing opened?
A few minutes ago, I checked a couple of candidates for school board, someone on the Town Davidson board, and then in Charlotte City Council District 3, Montravius King has filed. That's, he will be challenging incumbent Tijuana Brown, and he had previously said that he was going to run, so that's not a surprise, but that is official, that there will be a competitive race in West and Southwest Charlotte.
Okay. And you know, Mike, the presumption is that on the city council that pretty much everybody is running. I mean, it's interesting. If you ask them, I think a lot of them will not say straight up, I'm running for re-election. But I think the presumption is that unless you hear otherwise, that they're going to be on that ballot.
And some of that hesitancy, Joe, could be coming from the fact that we don't know what the mayor's intentions are. And there are people on council who are lining up behind her should she decide not to run. And they can't be running for two offices at the same time. So that's kind of thrown a wrench in the works. So the mayor has been keeping this decision to herself. We asked her on this program about a month ago whether she intended to run. And she responded, quote, as long as this community believes that I have something to contribute, then I will always try to do my very best to serve. Has she said anything more since May?
No, that's a very like... That's a very political answer. it's almost like you put in a ChatGPT. Give me some words to make it sound like so-and-so without saying it. So that's really, you know, the mayor's been around a long time, so she knows that how to answer that question. To stop rambling, no. She has not indicated it. I called someone very close to her last week, and they also weren't able to provide me with any timing or information, but we'll see, you know, I have a post-it note on my computer, like that virtual post-it note. It has a list of like eight names of people that I think would, you know, be in the mix for considering whether to run if she does not. I'd be interested in seeing if any of them file like in the next couple of days, or if they wait to the last minute waiting to see what the mayor does.
Steve.
Yeah, you know, Joe said just a second ago, the mayor's been around a long time. And this weekend, as we were preparing for the show, I kind of started looking at the numbers and her tenure. So if she runs again and wins re-election and serves her term, she will have been mayor for 10 years. That will be the second longest tenure of anyone ever in the city. Pat McCrory did 14. And then she... Vi Lyle served 4 years before on city council, worked her entire career in city government, a pretty remarkable run.
And we'll talk about that. And we'll talk about why she's being coy about this at this point in her career in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the election season, the local election season, which gets underway this morning. The filing Options or opportunities began at 8 o'clock this morning for candidates for school board, city council, and mayor. Steve Harrison is with us. He's our WFAE politics reporter. Joe Bruno is also with us, who reports on politics and other things for WSOC-TV. And Tony Mecia, founder and executive editor of the Charlotte Ledger. And Tony, for someone who served as long as Mayor Lyles has been in her position, why do you suppose she is being relatively coy about her decision of, about whether or not to run? Would you take from this that this is a difficult decision for her to make?
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like she's always sort of done this, left open the question of whether she's running again. And it is generally assumed that she is going to run. And it's also kind of assumed that she's basically unbeatable, that anybody who would oppose her, either in the Democratic primary or in the Republic, or as a Republican in the general election, would lose. And so it is a little bit puzzling, but this is, she does this a lot. So, I mean, maybe it's a positioning where, okay, if I say I'm announcing and then everything else falls into play, you know, down ballot on some of these other races. I don't really have a good sense of that. I mean, I do think if you talk to people, you know, close to the mayor and close to the city council, they sort of describe her as being maybe not as enthusiastic or as having as much fire in the belly maybe as she did before. I mean, she is 72. You know, at the end of this next term, she would be 75. You know, so she's getting, I mean, we're all getting older, but you know, it is sort of interesting to see how that's, you know, how that's worked out and how that plays out. And sort of, it is kind of a little bit puzzling to me why she does that.
So let's talk about this Post-it note on your computer, Joe.
All right, yeah, let's do it.
A possible candidate, should she decide not to run. I know among them would be Dimple Ashmira and Malcolm Graham.
Yeah, those are the top two, just because they kind of have laid the groundwork behind the scenes. Like, whether it's obvious or not to people that aren't involved with this every day, I'm not sure. But those are probably the top two names on all of our list, should Vi Lyles not run for re-election. You know, call one is going to Dimple, call two is going to Graham, and we'll kind of see where chips fall if the mayor were to not run. But I think you could say really all the at-large council members could, you know, would likely take a look at it. James Mitchell, Luana Mayfield, Victoria Watlington has certainly been high profile lately. On the county commission side, Mark Jarrell, Lee Altman, two names that I think would, you know, be in the mix on lists. Braxton Winston as well. I think you could put him on the list as a potential candidate should he want to return to Charlotte City Council.
You didn't mention Dante Anderson, who is
she's
also
on there. One more.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Add her. Yes.
Because she won the position of mayor pro tem against Victoria Watlington and was the top vote getter, I believe, in the last municipal elections for city council 2 years ago. Does that put her in a stronger position than Dimple or perhaps Malcolm? Should she try to run?
Dante Anderson ran for District 1. She's my representative, actually. So she wasn't the top vote getter. She is the mayor pro tem, though, and has really elevated her role on Charlotte City Council in the past 2 years. I could argue maybe more than any other council member, you know, her or another. She's up there in the top of council members who have really stepped into the role and put themselves out there over the last 2 years, though. And she would be a candidate for either mayor or at large should there be a shakeup.
So, Steve, these are all Democrats because we only have two Republicans on the city council, one elected, one appointed at the moment, Edwin Peacock, who took the place of the other Republican, Tariq Bakari. But are these people talking about this amongst themselves? Do we know? Are they having conversations? Are they feeling each other out? Are they really talking to the mayor? Is she talking to them? Or is this just going to happen when it happens, if it happens?
I think the mayor has probably shared her plans with probably her closest allies on the council. You know, I assume Dante Anderson, the mayor pro tem, is probably in the know on this. Dante Anderson has kind of helped the mayor run a lot of meetings, and they're very aligned on policy issues, et cetera. But I think a lot of the others are in the dark too, and just trying to read the tea leaves, just like we are. And, you know, to go back to Joe's list of eight names, whenever the mayor doesn't run, whether it's 2025 or 2027, I mean, it will be chaos. There will be so many people jumping in the race. And then, of course, once you run, you commit to run for mayor, you give up your existing seat. So there will be probably a pretty significant house cleaning or change of the guard on city council when that happens.
Yeah, and I guess that's a question that should be asked. Is that part of the reason, Tony, why she's perhaps going to go down to the wire on this decision to keep people in place as opposed to having them scattered to the winds because she knows how to control this board?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's an open question whether she knows how to control this board if you watch any of those meetings. I mean, it does get a little bit unruly at times. And, you know, you do have a couple different factions. The mayor and has allies and can pretty much get six or seven votes for kind of whatever she wants to do. But you have this other faction, sort of the Victoria Watlington, Renee Johnson, a few others, you know, that have been increasingly vocal in their criticism of some of the things that the city is proposing. And so I think when you look at the mayor, and this is just sort of speculation, but if you look at it, I think she sort of feels a calling to kind of, you know, who would jump into that chaos, you know, that Steve described, you know, who would actually lead. And I think she feels like she could lead. She can lead this board effectively, you know, and also, you know, I think it's also for her, you know, if this transit plan goes through, I mean, that's a nice legacy for her to kind of get that kicked off. If that goes through, get that up and running, get this authority that would determine how the money is spent, get that going. That would be kind of a nice capstone to her career as mayor, I think.
So Joe, whether or not Mayor Lyles decides to run for re-election, are we likely to see a Republican candidate emerge? And if so, what would they have to do to win in a very blue city?
I don't know if we will see a serious Republican candidate. And I'm not sure if Republicans, you know, just knowing the demographics of this city and how, you know, Democrat is probably going to get 65% just for having a D next to their name at a bare minimum in a mayoral race. I'm not sure Republicans can do better than Vi Lyles on the Democratic side, if that makes sense. So like knowing that Republicans would have an increasingly hard time at winning the mayoral seat. If you're looking at the list of Democrat candidates for mayor, I think if you're a Republican, you would want Vi Lyles because she elevated Ed Driggs to a point where Ed Driggs was running point for the transit plan. And Tark Bakary certainly had his say on issues, even if they did clash at numerous times. So I think that Republicans have generally a good deal with Vi Lyles, the person who advocated for their Republican National Convention to come to Charlotte. So if you are a Republican, if you don't have that legitimate, serious candidate, I think that they can be at least happy with the current leadership.
So Tony, what are, as we wait people to file, and a few have, but not many, what are the requirements for people who want to run for any of these offices, city council or mayor or school board? What are the requirements? What must you do?
Well, I mean, I Joe and Steve might know better than I do, but it's pretty wide open. I mean, in a lot of these, if it is a partisan race like the city council is, you have to be, you know, registered in the party that you're running for. I mean, you pay a little bit of a fee. You know, you fill out some forms. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, pretty much, you know, anybody can do it. I mean, you have to, you know, you can't be a convicted felon actively serving a sentence. There are things like that, but I mean, it's you know, it is pretty much open to just about anybody.
Okay, all of the incumbents on council, as we've said, are expected to announce that they are running again, assuming that there is no shakeup in the mayor's race. Does that mean it is likely, Joe, that the council will be comprised mostly of the same players, with the exception of Tark Bakary, who gave up his seat to go to Washington? And how might that affect voter interest and turnout?
We'll see. It's really hard to beat an incumbent, but it's happened before. Larkin Eggleston took down Patsy Kinsey. And I do think that there will be some competitive primaries. District 3 certainly will be the most competitive or most attention, I would argue, because Tijuana Brown, who is charged with, who was federally indicted, is going to run for re-election, she says. and she will have multiple primary challengers. And last year, the big primary story was Renee Johnson. She faced a mayor-backed primary opponent, Will Russell. Will take another stab at that seat? If so, will the mayor be as out front with her support of Will, or will she stick by or be more muted with Renee, since recently those two have been trying to work together as a result of the numerous controversies we've seen in the past couple of
weeks? Let's talk a moment about Tijuana Brown, Steve. I believe this is right. This is the first time in Charlotte history that we have an incumbent member of council who is under federal indictment, accused of committing wire fraud. She and her daughters have both been accused of that by the Department of Justice for filing false applications for federal pandemic relief loans and spending that money on personal expenses, including a lavish birthday party for Brown. These crimes allegedly occurred before Tijuana Brown was on Charlotte City Council. All three have pleaded not guilty in their first court appearance, and Brown has been adamant about her intention both not to resign and to run again for re-election. So should this indictment be on the minds of voters? Is it likely to affect her chances in this election in her district?
I think it will be a part of the race. I think it will be on the minds of a lot of voters. Like we talked about at the top of the show, there's already one candidate, Montrevious King, who has filed. There will be at least one other. And I think for Tijuana Brown, the conventional wisdom says that the more candidates run, that benefits the incumbent because she just has to get to 30%. I think that will help her. She has a lot of deep support. She grew up in the district. She grew up on the west side in Southside Homes. And so there are some deep connections there. I think one thing that'll be interesting is, will a Republican file? Because let's say if Tijuana Brown does win the primary, it's a heavily Democratic district, but with her legal troubles, I think that actually could conceivably open up the door to a Republican possibly winning that seat, if you combine Republican votes, unaffiliated votes, and some Democrats.
Joe?
I don't know about Republican, but I have heard at least one unaffiliated candidate is taking a look at running for that seat. The process is that unaffiliated candidate, I believe, has until end of September-ish to gather enough signatures to get on the ballot, and that would be an interesting wrinkle in the November race for that district.
Steve.
You know, Mike, at the beginning of the show, we talked about why turnout is so low here. And then Joe just mentioned having an unaffiliated candidate run. I think another thing it's important to talk about is that most American cities have nonpartisan elections. We are very unusual to have partisan elections. Most cities in North Carolina have nonpartisan elections, which means that unaffiliated candidates can just easily run. It's just, you don't have to go through any crazy hoops. But here in Charlotte, it is this elaborate process to get on the ballot. It's very hard. And when we talked about one reason why turnout is so low, one big reason is we do partisan elections.
So has Tijuana Brown filed for re-election yet this morning? Okay, so we don't know for certain that she's going to do it. We were assuming that she will, and if she does, we have said that she will likely face two Democratic challengers. One of them. Oh, great! I have a smoke alarm going off. This is fabulous.
Are you okay, Mike? Do you need to evacuate?
No, I don't need to evacuate. So anyway, we have she's facing two challengers, Joy Mayo and Montrevious King. What do we know about them?
Montrevious King has political ties. I believe he served as a legislative assistant in the past. I believe he was a legislator in Elizabeth City. Correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, but he has a history. Joy Mayo is a community activist. She is very involved in the nation's Ford community. She took a look at running for the seat last time around, but ran into party registration hiccups, from my understanding. So those two are at least looking at the seat. One of them already has filed, Montrevious. And it should be noted that Councilmember Brown had two challengers in the primary last time. She finished about 1,000 or so votes ahead of the nearest finisher, a former Charlotte City Councilman who himself happened to have a controversial past. So we will see exactly what types of themes come up in this campaign. It also should be noted that should she be convicted of the felony, she would have to resign her seat if she wins re-election. And, you know, just thinking about when Patrick Cannon ran for re-election a couple of years ago, and it was a very competitive at-large race with six very legitimate contenders for those four seats. Council members were very kind, and they did not bring up Patrick Cannon's history, or, you know, they all just stayed in their own lane and they said, like, hey, I'm running on my own merits. And it'll be interesting to see how hard candidates go in this particular race, if they kind of stick with that Charlotte kindness in races, or if they turn it up a notch, knowing that there are some serious charges that Tijuana Brown is accused of and that Brown extremely denies.
And do we know what the timeline is for federal prosecution on that, when the trial might begin?
We do not. They only have had one appearance in court. Their next appearance in court is another month or two from now, is actually extended out. So no, we don't have a timeline.
Those things usually take a while, though. I mean, this is not a quick resolution unless you get some plea, right?
Unless you get a guilty plea, and Brown has said she is not going to plead guilty under any circumstances. Because again, that guilty plea means you have to give up your seat.
Right, your seat. So let's move to District 6. We have district and at-large races for city council. But in District 6, Tarek Bakari resigned to go to Washington to become the number two person in the Department of Transportation in the Trump administration. Edwin Peacock III is filling that seat. He was appointed. He promised not to run. Is he likely to keep that promise, Steve?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's possible that Edwin Peacock, and it's possible that he could run for something else, like an at-large seat, but I don't think he's going to run for the District 6 seat. I think Krista Bakari, Tarek Bakari's wife, is going to run. And then on the Democratic side, we've had one person who's announced, Kimberly Owens, has not filed yet, but is announced. And then, of course, there's kind of the wild card in there. Stephanie Hand, a Democrat, ran for the seat in the last two elections. Will she run again, or will she maybe try for an at-large seat? Big question.
And, you know, let's, you remember, this is a pretty competitive seat. I mean, this was pretty, I mean, Bakari only won those last two elections by, you know, a few hundred votes. So this is viewed as, you know, fairly competitive.
And we will talk about that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison, our political reporter for WFAE News, is with us, along with Joe Bruno, reporter for WSOC-TV, and Tony Macia with the Charlotte Ledger. He's the founder and executive editor there. Before we talk more about District 6, I'm told that we have another candidate who just filed for mayor, Tigress Sydney Acute McDaniel. What do we know about her?
She runs for office frequently. She ran for mayor last time around. She did not win or garner much support, but the mayor, if she runs for re-election, she will have a primary challenge from Ms. McDaniel.
Okay. So we talked about District 6 a bit before this started. Has the complexion of that district, which has been represented by a Republican for a while, although, as you pointed out, Tony, Tarek Bakari, the last person elected to that seat, faced a pretty stiff competition from Stephanie Hand two times in a row in that district, and she has not announced whether she will come back. But Stephanie Hand may come back. Tarek Bakari's wife, Krista Bakari, wants to run. She wanted to be appointed to the seat when it was given to Edwin Peacock. And then there's also Democrat Kimberly Owens, a corporate lawyer, who may run in that. Can a Democrat win in that district?
I think the thinking is yes. I mean, if you had the right Democrat, if the matchup was right, I mean, in these low turnout elections, you know, even you say, well, it's a South Charlotte district, it's Republican. But if you look at it, it's actually fairly close. It's fairly even. So I think it is winnable, you know, for a Democrat. And like we said, Stephanie Hahn came very close. So, you know, it's not inconceivable to think that could open up to a Democrat or it could be competitive. I mean, you never really know, but you know, and then you look at sort of the national trends of sort of the more suburban areas, you know, having some questions about, you know, Republicans and, you know, with the things that are going on nationally. So you don't really know, but I would think it has the potential to be a competitive matchup.
Ed Driggs is the other Republican, Steve. He's represented District 7 since, I think, 2013. And the last time he ran, he walked away with 85% of the vote. Well, I don't think he's filed yet this morning, but has he announced his intentions?
He has not. I think it's kind of widely assumed that that if Mayor Lyles runs again, Councilmember Driggs will run as well. They've become very, you know, close working relationship, and he's a big ally of hers. As Joe said, he pushed the transportation plan forward. So I would expect him to run again, assuming the mayor does. I think there is another race, I think, that's going to be worth watching on East Charlotte in District 5. Marjorie Molina is the incumbent, but she's drawn an opponent. J.D. Masuera Arias has already, I think, has the makings. I mean, he's raised money, has campaign infrastructure. That is going to be, you know, along with 4, 3, and 6, one to watch.
Yeah, he describes himself, Tony, as a public servant, organizer, and public policy advocate. How does that help him?
Well, I think he's looking at, you know, he's kind of tying in, I think, some of these sort of national issues, maybe thing, you know, and trying to, you know, put himself out there as someone who's, you know, involved in the community. You know, it's interesting, you know, we often think of, you know, East Charlotte that has a high Latino population. Marjorie Molina, of course, speaks Spanish. You know, Juan Diego, Missouri Arias, J.D. Arias, he, you know, he is Hispanic. So it is interesting to see sort of how that might play out. Obviously, it's hard for any newcomer, you know, to unseat an incumbent, as we've been talking about. But I mean, I think he's trying to put himself out there as someone who's active and involved and maybe has a little bit of a different point of view than Marjorie Molina.
Joe.
Yeah, real quick, going back to Miss McDaniel, she got 2.37% in the school board at large election last time around. She ran for mayor in 2022 when she got 5%. I just wanted to get those stats correct there. Now, as for Marjorie Molina in District 5, I think one perk or advantage she will have is she will likely have the mayor's full support and infrastructure. One advantage the mayor has by not really ever having a well-funded, heavily backed challenger is she's able to offer her support to allies and people she wants to see on council. And Marjorie Molina certainly has showed up for the mayor, and I expect she will step out for her this election.
Steve.
Yeah, I think both what Tony and Joe said is exactly right. I think it'll be interesting. Tony kind of alluded to this, that this race, if it does kind of take off and heat up, I think it will be a little bit of a microcosm of kind of national Democratic politics, and that J.D. Arias will be running a really, I expect, a much more progressive campaign to the left of Marjorie Molina. And it'll be interesting to see if some of those national narratives that we see dividing the Democratic Party, if they kind of resonate with voters. You know, it's hard in these races. It's so hard to break through and to have your message break through when so few people vote and so few people pay attention. But that seems to be the direction the race is heading.
Let's back up to District 4. It's comprised primarily of the university area. Renee Johnson is the incumbent. She is expected to face a challenger, as you pointed out, in the Democratic primary, Will Russell. And as I think it was you, Joe, who pointed out that the mayor backed Mr. Russell in a previous election, which he lost 2 years ago. And Johnson has been a point of friction for Mayor Lyles on city council. The mayor has described Johnson as not being part of the team that works with her and city staff to implement policy. And she has often challenged city staff and opposed key parts of the mayor's agenda, including the 2040 comprehensive plan. So talk us through this split among Democrats on council. Why is that? What is it about Renee Johnson that puts her on the opposite side sometimes?
I think that Johnson truly serves her district, where if there is somebody who has concerns about something, Ms. Johnson is going to heavily investigate them, and to the point where she may, you know, push back on certain things that may have already been established or settled on city council. I think Johnson is probably the council member who is the fiercest critic of development. I'm trying to figure out if that's how I want to phrase that. I think she takes the closest look at development proposals in her district and other district. And for that reason, she has earned a lot of neighborhood support. But, you know, I think you can, from a council perspective, some council members think that Johnson may, you know, go against the grain too much or try to relitigate things to the point where things get held up.
Well, speaking of people who are at odds with the mayor, there are three at-large seats up for grabs, and one of them is held by Victoria Watlington, who has been a critic of council dysfunction. She is the council member, Steve, who alleged unethical, immoral, and possibly illegal conduct by either the council or city staff or both, a comment which has started an investigation by the city attorney and possibly by the state auditor. Some say she has become a progressive dissenter on council, clashing both with the mayor and with her centrist colleagues. Is that a fair description? And either way, are her comments likely to win or lose her support?
Fascinating question as to whether that will help her or not in the at-large race. Should she run again? You know, because remember, she did finish first in the 2023 race, which was a bit of a surprise. And Victoria Wallington is part of that group on council that wants the city to move farther to the left. Renee Johnson, Tijuana Brown, Victoria Watlington, sometimes Dimple Ejimera, Luana Mayfield, that they are trying to pull the city in a little bit more to the left. We saw that recently with this vote over whether to try and find a way to pay the contract workers at the airport more money, which was an issue that really touched a nerve among big business, among American Airlines, Republicans, and that the mayor put an end to that. But there is this kind of growing block on city council. They don't have a majority, but they are getting close. And I think that'll be one interesting thing in this election to see whether that block is able to grow in size, whether it stays the same, whether it shrinks. I think that'll be fun to watch.
And you mentioned you lumped in Dimple Ejimera among the people who want to push the council a little more to the left. She's one of the other at-large incumbents. Is she likely to run for re-election? And if she does, will she face opposition, do we think?
She will run for re-election, I'm pretty sure. I think it's going to be difficult for, you know, we have four incumbents, and assuming kind of everything stays as is, it's going to be difficult for someone to come in and beat one of them, you know?
Yeah, I think two people potentially could. I don't know if they would run, though. Larkin Eggleston comes to mind. I think he could have a shot at getting on council if he were to run at large this cycle, but he hasn't expressed any interest in that. He'll probably text me now saying, Joe, why'd you bring me up on there? The other person would be Stephanie Hand. If she took a look at running for at large, I think she could mount a serious campaign and have a real good shot at one of those four slots.
And let's talk a minute about the other at-large person, James Mitchell. Has he declared, does he have opposition? He has, I'm told, has frequently missed campaign finance filing deadlines. Will that become an issue? Joe.
Campaign finance, I don't know if that really resonates with voters too much, that particular issue. James Mitchell has had a long career in Charlotte City Council. He has a lot of support in the community. I think no matter what he runs for, if he chooses to run, he will be seen as a serious contender.
We haven't talked. I guess it's true that Braxton Winston's name came up, Tony, with regard to possibly running for mayor, should Mayor Lyles not decide not to run. But what about another city council seat? He stepped down from council to run for labor commissioner in North Carolina, lost that race, but some speculate that he might run for council again. He's been quiet. If that's his intent, what have we heard?
At large could be another option for Braxton Winston as well. Okay. He's definitely in that category, and he is politically active. He's going to pretty much all of the Charlotte City Council meetings. He stayed right to the end of that airport discussion. He was wearing a T-shirt backing the union workers who called for that raise. He is an outspoken critic, will probably be the top critic of the transit plan vote as well. Not necessarily that he disagrees with the idea of transit expansion, but just about how this deal was crafted and the provisions of the law. So I do think he would be a strong at-large or strong candidate for whatever he decides to run for.
Did you want to add to that, Tony, or are you okay with that?
I completely agree with Joe. Okay. No, I mean, I don't know that I see him running. I mean, he would be a strong contender, but he wouldn't necessarily have a easy seat to try to get at-large because you have four pretty solid incumbents as well. So that would be really interesting if he ran. I'm not sure he's going to, but I guess we'll find out in the next couple weeks.
So we can assume that most, if not all, of the current holders of these seats on city council will ultimately file for re-election, whether or not they have any competition is to be seen. But the current council voted to settle a potential lawsuit with the chief of police to the tune of $305,000. They made that decision behind closed doors. They also offered a payout to the former city attorney, about which they have provided few details and have yet to give a reason for his dismissal. And there have been other incidences about which the city has been less than transparent in the face of media scrutiny and also citizen criticism. So, Steve, what role, if any, do you see any of that playing in how voters approach this election in November?
Hard to say. You know, going back to what Joe talked about earlier in the District 3 race as to whether the gloves will come off or whether it will be kind of Charlotte nice politics as usual. I think, I don't know. I there are certainly issues there for people to talk about. But so many of these races are kind of the candidate forums. They tend to kind of go over the same issues. I want more housing, et cetera, transits. It's very rare to see people really come out swinging. And maybe that will change this time. Maybe it'll be the status quo.
Well, if you're looking to see who's running for school board, do not ask artificial intelligence. They will get it wrong, as it did this weekend. But Tony Mesilla is on top of it, and there are six district seats. All six are up for grabs on Charlotte Mecklenburg School Board. Let's talk about these people. Melissa Easley is in District 1. Do we know if she's going to run again?
I think this is similar to the city council, where we're sort of assuming everybody is running unless we hear otherwise. We have, and if you thought that the city council was sort of not on people's minds, I can tell you the Charles Mecklenburg Board of Education is definitely not on people's minds. You know, it's like, is there an election? Really? But yeah, like
it's
you said,
not even
seats.
On artificial intelligence's mind.
I know. ChatGPT doesn't know it, you know, then it doesn't really exist. But yeah, so six seats, you know, Melissa Easley in District 1. I know I saw, there is going to be a challenger, it sounds like, on that filed this morning, Bill Fountain, for District 1 and the school board. And then really quickly, the other incumbents, Stephanie Sneed, Dee Rankin, Lisa Klein, and Summer Nunn. Incumbent Thelma Byers Bailey, who has been on the school board since 2013, long tenure there. She is not running again. She's endorsed nonprofit leader Shamaya Haynes, who ran for an at-large seat in 2023. So again, we sort of assume that most of the incumbents are running, and that most of them will be pretty strong candidates.
And these are all incumbents in districts. The at-large incumbents are not running. They'll run next time. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, these are four-year terms, unlike the city council, which two-year terms. The school board is four-year terms, and they stagger them. So the at-large folks were elected 2 years ago, and they'll be up in 2 years. And this year, it's the it's the district seats. And you know, the school board has been kind of under the radar. There was a period of time a few years ago where I know you did a lot of panels on them, Mike. It was pretty high profile. There were a lot of questions, you know, during COVID and Ernest Winston's leadership and things like that. It's been kind of fairly no drama. I think there's been some staff changes, principal, you know, resignations and suspensions at a few schools that I know some parents have gotten pretty agitated about. But, you know, it's been pretty low drama. And so, we expect it to be kind of under the radar.
Well, filing continues till July the 18th for the primary race, which will be, I think, in September, and then the general election in November. So we'll be following this for the next several months. Steve Harrison, WFAE's politics reporter, with us this morning. Tony Macia, the last voice you heard from the Charlotte Ledger, and Joe Bruno, who reports for WSOC-TV. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.